From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf.
And shots were fired, apparently at President Reagan, as he was coming out of the Washington Hilton Hotel this afternoon. The president was not hit. He was pushed into his limousine and immediately taken away to safety. However, three persons were hit. We believe they are two Secret Service agents and the president's press secretary, James Brady. And we do not know the condition of any of the men.
On March 30th, 1981, John Hinckley attempted to assassinate President Ronald Reagan outside the Washington Hilton Hotel, wounding the president, press secretary James Brady, a Secret Service agent, police officer. My guest this week, Del Quentin Wilbur, is the author of a detailed account of this event. The book is Rawhide Down, The Near Assassination of Ronald Reagan. Del Quentin Wilbur, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, everybody who was alive on November 22nd, 1963, famously remembers where they were, including me. But I don't think people have that same feeling about March 30th, 1981.
You know, what's so strange is that I actually think a lot of them do. At all these readings and things around the country that I go to, the line to sign books invariably gets longer. They're not long lines, but they get a little longer because everyone wants to tell me how they remembered where they were that day. Oh, my teacher came into the class, wheeled in the thing. I think it's a generational thing. So I think if you are just too young to have remembered Kennedy very well, this was a defining moment in your life growing up. It's like, for my generation, it's obviously 9/11 and, you know, maybe Waco. We all kind of remember the burning building in Waco. But, you know, I was 6 years old when this happened, and I have no recollection of the event at all. Many, many, many people of the generation that just a little too young to remember Kennedy, and those who do remember Kennedy, if they were Reagan, kind of Reagan fans, or if they liked more of the conservatives, seem to remember that day a lot better, where they were, how they heard the news.
Well, yeah, you know, it doesn't surprise me that you're younger than me, because I saw your picture and you look very young. But the way that you characterize President Reagan in the first part of your book, you obviously have strong feelings about him.
Well, what's interesting is people. It's so funny. Some people have read the book and thought I was not nice enough. And some people have read the book and said I was too nice to write it. And this is a day where a guy gets shot and nearly dies. And so, you know, you're obviously pulling for him to survive, right?
Sure.
And you got to set the stage of why we care that he survived. And he made a ton of history. And I actually did come to – I didn't know much about the guy, frankly. You know, I probably shouldn't say the guy. The president. I didn't know much about the president at that time.
We call him the guy.
I covered Federal Courthouse for the Washington Post. And I only came across this kind of by accident, and, you know, approaching Reagan as an historic figure kind of made me a bit nervous because so much had been written about him. But the more I read about him, and frankly, I knew as much about him as I knew about any president that's kind of an historic figure to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I knew a lot about John Adams because I read the John Adams biography. I knew a lot about Truman because I also read that biography. I knew a lot about Kennedy because I read all the Kennedy assassination stuff because it interested me. You know, LBJ, I think I got through the first volume of Manchester's thing, and all, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, all those things, and I knew a little bit about Reagan because I think I'd read one Reagan biography, but I didn't know him, right? And so he was just kind of a distant figure to me, not like Bill Clinton or George Bush or George Bush the older, you know, who were kind of more formulative as presidents in my recollection. In fact, I got this idea to write the book. I'm covering the federal courthouse, and John Hinckley, who shot Reagan and three other men on March 30th, 1981, was having a he was found not guilty by reason of insanity, and he has these periodic hearings in federal court to get more freedom, you know, and he's going to have a bunch more in October. And, you know, I'm covering these hearings, it's kind of interesting, and I write my story and I move on. That's what we do in journalism. You cover stuff, and I found him intriguing because he had such a flat effect on his face during the whole proceeding, even when they talked about his sex life. It was just bizarre. It's like someone had taken a mask of his face the night before and stuck it on his face, and there's no emotion. You know how you have no emotion when you're sleeping?
Yeah.
Just placid. That was his face when they're talking about, like, his sexual escapades, you know? I'm like, huh? But it kind of stuck with me. And then a few days later, a week later, this FBI official calls me over to his office, the Washington field office, and they want to talk me out of writing a story I'd heard about on an undercover investigation. And I don't, you know, whatever. It was about Ethiopian taxi cab drivers in the district bribing D.C. officials. And if you cover D.C. long enough, you know, D.C. bribery scandals are not that uncommon. And so I'm like, oh, okay, whatever. So I go over there, and like, you can't write this story. You'll wreck our case, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, whatever. And he gets up from his conference table, walks over to a desk. I hear him rummage through a drawer, literally rummage through a drawer, come over, and he slaps something heavy in my hand. And I look down. It's a gun. I went, whoa, you really don't want me to write this story, you know? That's pretty intimidating. He gets handed a gun, and he goes, that's John Hinckley's gun.
Well, no, that's kind of a non sequitur. I mean, why did he happen to have...
Right. Yeah. And I said, well, why do you have this gun? And then he's like, oh, and there's this long explanation about how they used to have a museum downstairs. It got closed after 9/11. And in other words, he just kind of kept it as a conversation starter, right? And a token piece. And I'm like, well, if this is an historic artifact, and if this is how this critical artifact from this historic day is treated... And when I first started the book, this is when I first get the idea, I went to the library, tried to find a book on it, because now I'm really curious, because I want to read more. Nothing, not a single book. And I was like, And I was like, if this is how history treats this critical artifact from a day that almost changed history, you know, and at the time I thought almost changed history. In reality, in all this research, it did change history.
Yeah.
And so that's where I started with it. And then, you know, and I'm calling Jerry Parr, the lead agent who saves Reagan's life not once but twice. And I'm like talking to him, and he's like, you know, the next thing you know, I'm like, oh my God, how has no one done this before?
Right. Yeah. No. I mean, it's a fascinating book, and you really give us all the details, and that's really great. And I want to mention the book again. It's called Rawhide Down: The Near Assassination of Ronald Reagan, and my guest Del Quinton Wilbur is the author. Take us a little bit, you know, through that day of March 30th, 1981.
Oh, sure. You know, so you know, it's a average. You know, this is Reagan's 70th day in office. This is really early. You wouldn't believe the number of people who come up to you and say, "Oh, I thought it was 1987." No, it was 1981. Literally, he's in office for 70 days, and he's delivering this routine speech to the Washington Hilton Hotel. And, you know, people are always asking me, like, what surprised you about this? What, you know, and, you know, one of the things that surprised me is that, you know, my perception of Ronald Reagan, and this is gets to your original question, you know, what do you think of Reagan? And I thought he kind of read from a script given to him, that's because he was an actor, and I think I'd maybe read Luke Cannon's biography, which is really good, The Role of a Lifetime.
Right.
Maybe I'd read that before. I can't remember. Anyway, and I thought, you know, he was mostly an actor kind of guy. And he rewrote the speech that he gave that day by hand. He rewrote it by hand over the weekend. And, you know, that to me was really intriguing, because I've seen a lot of presidents who tinker with speeches or do this, but he actually took the time to rewrite a routine speech by hand. So that's really important to him. And
could,
that gave me
it could be an actor's technique for learning lines.
No, I mean, you should see the end. You should actually see what he did.
From the, you know that it's different than the speech that he copied it from.
Oh, no, this is a hand. I saw his handwritten rewrite.
Uh-huh.
No, he actually, I saw the original draft by the speechwriter that he took.
Uh-huh,
he crossed it all out, and on a piece of paper rewrote it.
Interesting, yeah.
By hand, and I saw the rewrite. You know, he did it. You know, and he did borrow quotes from quote cards that he kept, but, like, it was much better. It flowed, and it was like, you know, he littered it with some historical stuff, and he rewrote paragraphs, and the speechwriter was no chump. You know, she's Mari Massing. She's a very intelligent lady, and, you know, she'd written a lot of great speeches over the years, and this is, you know, he made it better. And I wasn't expecting to see that on this day in particular. Like, you know, the big speeches, you would expect to see it, you know, him tinkering or telling people what to do, but not just a wholesale rewrite by himself. Anyway, so he delivers this speech. It's 2:27 p.m. He delivers the speech at the Washington Hilton. It's 2:27 p.m. He's leaving. He's walking towards his waiting limousine. About 15 feet from the president, as he nears the limousine, is a rope line, totally unsecured. Behind that rope line is, you know, Sam Donaldson, one of the famous TV guys, for example, who's on the body watch in case anything happens. He has to be there. Cameramen, union guys, a couple of union guys are joking around going, oh, let's count his wrinkles. Let's see how close we can get. And John W. Hinckley, Jr. John W. Hinckley, Jr. is a deranged 25-year-old from Evergreen, Colorado, who is simply passing through Washington that day on his way to New Haven, Connecticut, where he wants to kill the object of his affection, Jodie Foster, the actress. She had gone to Yale to escape Hollywood, but she brought this psycho with her, and that's a harsh term, I shouldn't have used that term, but, you know, this guy who is obsessed with her and he stalks her there in fall of 1980.
You're saying psycho is too harsh a term to use for Hinckley?
I don't know. I think he definitely had some deep psychological problems, and I guess the jury did find him, you know, not guilty by reason of insanity. I'd been usually deranged, but I guess you're really too carefully parsing psycho and deranged, maybe. I don't know.
And you say that he was planning on murdering Jodie Foster?
Yes. In late 1980, he had stalked her. He'd stuffed notes under her doors. Yeah. He even called her repeatedly. Mm-hmm. And, like, he tape-recorded the calls. And I got to read the transcripts of these calls. They're bizarre. That's like, you know, he's just destroyed when she wants nothing to do with him, which is not surprising, frankly.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he gets in his mind, I'm going to get the President of the United States to impress her. And so in 1980, he's stalking Jimmy Carter, the President. And he gets within arm's reach of him at a rally in Dayton, Ohio. But he left his guns behind at the bus locker. Mm. And so, and he stalks Reagan during the transition. And then that kind of goes away. And now by March 1980, his life is completely rending. I mean, his parents cut him off for money. He has nowhere to go. His life, he wanted to be a songwriter, has fallen apart. And he's obsessed with Jodie Foster. So he's planning to go through D.C. as a way station and head up to New Haven that day to kill himself, kill her, or kill both of them in this orgy of violence. That's what he wants to do. He's on his way up there. Well, he wakes up that morning at the Park Central Hotel, and he sees he eats an Egg McMuffin sandwich at a McDonald's, and he comes back to his room and picks up the Washington Star newspaper. And on page A4 is the president's schedule, detailed schedule of the president that day. And he says, maybe I'll go up to the Hilton and see how close I can get with my gun. And he even writes Jodie Foster a note. You know, like, you know, if I succeed in my attempt to get Reagan, something or other, you know, whatever. He's like, now you'll know who I am, basically. Really know who I am. He writes it, sticks it in his bag, grabs his gun, loads it, this six-shot revolver, sticks it in his pocket, and takes a taxi up to the Washington Hilton Hotel. And he's there, 15 feet away from the president, as Reagan leaves this hotel from his speech. And Hinckley pulls out his gun and unleashes six shots in 1.7 seconds. The time it takes me to say 1.7 seconds is 1.7 seconds.
Hmm.
It's that fast. I mean, I timed it. Like, it's that fast. The first shot hits James Brady, the press secretary, in the head. He falls to the ground. The second shot hits Tom Delahanty, a D.C. police officer, in the back. He falls to the ground. And the way to Reagan should be clear. But Jerry Parr, 50-year-old head of the Secret Service detail, who wasn't even supposed to be there that day. He was, another agent was supposed to watch Reagan that day, guard Reagan, but Parr wanted to get to know Reagan better. He didn't know him very well, and so he took his place. And so here he is, 0.4 seconds after Hinckley fires his first shot, Jerry Parr is already reacting. He's shoving Reagan towards that open limousine door. The third shot goes high and hits a building across the street. And I'm not surprised that Hinckley missed at that point, because Hinckley took a ton of target practice to the point where he was even lying to him. He was seeing a psychiatrist in 1980, and telling him, oh, I was at the mall thinking about my future. No, in his journal entries, he was actually covering up the fact he was taking target practice.
Hmm.
He misses high, because he only took practice at stationary targets, and Jerry Parr is already moving the president towards the open limousine door. The fourth shot hits Tim McCarthy, a Secret Service agent, in the chest. Not wearing a bulletproof vest, he had spread-eagle to take a bullet for the president and falls to the ground. They're flashing behind him. The fifth shot hits a bulletproof window of the limousine as they flash behind that. The limousine's cool. This is a 1972 13,000-pound Lincoln Continental armored like crazy. And these doors open backwards. They're known as suicide doors. And it's fascinating because they stopped making those types of doors in the 60s. And I couldn't figure out why the 72 Lincoln has these backward-opening doors. But that backward-opening door blocks a bullet. They flash behind it. And the sixth shot cracks across the driveway. At the time, no one knows where that sixth shot went. Until later they realize it deflected off the back quarter panel of the limousine, slipped through a gap an inch and a half wide between the door and the doorframe, and struck Reagan 5 inches below his left armpit.
Well, he was already in the car when he was shot.
He was like reaching out. Imagine you're like diving for home plate.
Yeah.
You're sliding home plate head first, and your arms are outstretched. And that's where he's being thrown into the car just like that, and the bullet slips in under his left armpit.
Hmm.
He lands in a tumble. The door shuts. And I like to tell, you know, this is crazy, okay? You've obviously seen a presidential motorcade before. They go on forever, like 20 vehicles, you know, like everything.
Okay.
Imagine this. Jerry Parr has propped Reagan up in the back seat. He looks out the window, sees three men on the cement, a bullet mark in the window, and that limousine is alone.
Huh.
That limousine's heading out Connecticut Avenue and left everyone else behind. This is a real assassination attempt, man. This is like, they're really shots fired. This is not a drill. And this limousine has nobody. It's on Connecticut Avenue all by itself,
wow,
taken off. The driver floored it. And in fact, he's going so fast at one point, he barely hits a woman pushing a stroller across the street. And they're just taken off. And about 30 seconds later, and everyone thinks Reagan's okay. And in fact, as they're pulling out, Jerry Parr, the agent, gets on the radio and says, Rawhide is okay. Rawhide is okay. And Rawhide is Reagan's Secret Service code name. Hence the title of the book, Rawhide Down.
And you say in the book that he loved that name.
He loved it. Absolutely. Of course he did. I mean, Reagan loved that image of being a cowboy, there's a funny, if we remember, remind me to tell you the funny story about in the end note. Reagan has, he's a wealth of, not only did I admire the guy as a president, or came to admire him as like a leader. I didn't agree with all of his policies, of course, but, as a leader and everything. But, I just liked him as a character in a book. I mean, you can't get a better character.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? If he was fiction, you couldn't make up what he did. Anyway.
So he didn't realize he'd been shot.
No. No one knew. That's why he thought he was okay. Even Reagan thought he was okay. And they're driving back, and 30 seconds later, the entire dynamic changed. The entire dynamic. Because at that moment, Reagan starts complaining about pain in his chest, and he dabs his lips with a napkin he'd taken from the Hilton. Bright, frothy blood is everywhere. Hmm. And Parr goes, oh, no. Now he's thinking, oh, my God, I broke his rib throwing the limousine, and it punctured the lung. What do I do? Because bright, frothy blood means it's coming from the lungs. It's oxygenated. What does Jerry Parr do? This is the height of the Cold War, 1981. These intelligence reports are coming across the desks of the highest reaches of the government about how the Russians are about to move on Poland. Okay? And here they are. They did have an assassination attempt. Jerry Parr doesn't know. They did a decapitation strike, World War III. What the hell's going on? And he's heading back to the White House, the safest place in the known universe. They have more guards per capita at the White House than like probably anywhere, and they're heading back there as fast as they can down Connecticut Avenue. But they also have a medical facility, so maybe Reagan's okay enough to get there and treat him there. Or he could divert to George Washington Hospital, 6 blocks away from the White House, where there's not a shred of security. They don't even have an agent stationed there, not even a cop. They have nothing. And other assassins could be waiting around, and Jerry Parr has to make the split-second decision on what to do. He's not going to take a chance. If he's wrong, too, by the way, and Reagan goes there and he's fine, he could probably incite a financial meltdown. Like, oh, my God, the president's been taken there.
Right.
Well, he goes to the hospital. They get there. Reagan walks in 30 feet or so. He even insists on walking in. And then he collapses like a dead weight into the arms of his agents. And actually, it was really interesting. I tracked down a paramedic who saw this happen. And this paramedic's very experienced. He was there at the time. And he's actually a guy I interviewed when I covered D.C. police for the Washington Post. He's still a paramedic in D.C. And he remembers, he goes, Dell, when I saw his eyes roll in the back of his head and him collapse, I thought, oh, my God, he's code city.
Hmm.
And paramedic speak means you're dead.
Right.
There's no coming back. A nurse is there going, please don't die, please don't die, please don't die. As they race him over to the gurney and put him on a gurney. There's a Wendy Koenig, another nurse is there. They're cutting off his clothes, a brand new suit just given to him by Nancy Reagan. They slice off this suit. They strap on a blood pressure cuff. She can't get the blood pressure. It's so low. She can't detect it. And another agent, another nurse, I can't get a pressure. I can't get a pressure. Another doctor, he screams out expletive, you better get that pressure,
Yeah.
And then she finally uses her fingers to feel it. It's 60. His blood pressure is 60. That's shock territory. Normal's 140. He is not necessarily going to make it. In fact, the doctors and nurses around don't think he's going to survive. Then, but they're still doing their jobs. In fact, a technician's there, and she threaded a 3-foot-long IV line in his right arm, snaked it all the way across his chest to his heart.
Hmm.
She does all that, and only then does she look up and see all the agents there in their suits and their earpieces and their guns, and then she looks down and sees it's Reagan. She turns around, shocks her. She gets smelling salts off the wall and sniffs them, shocks herself back into work to focus because she couldn't focus anymore. It's like, oh, my God, it's the president, and she gets back to her job. They're doing their jobs. They find out he's been shot. And if you have a dime, look at a dime.
Yeah.
Because this bullet got flattened into the shape of a dime, and it struck him edgewise. And so there's just a tiny little slit, so no blood's coming out. But when it entered his body, it hit a rib and deflected and tumbled end over end through his lung, tearing up all this tissue and arteries. And he's bleeding profusely, and they inserted a chest tube, and the blood comes out. And I like to say that Reagan's life on this day hung in the balance of a split second decision, and a mere inch. What do I mean by that, right? Split second. If Jerry Parr's a split second slower getting Reagan into that car, he gets it in the head. Just the trajectory of the bullet would have hit him in the head. If he hesitates at the scene like agents have done throughout history,
right,
he's a sitting duck. If he goes to the White House and not the hospital, the doctors emphatically tell me he would have died. In an inch, during surgery, Ben Aaron, they eventually know Reagan would lose more than half his blood this day, which is a lot for a 70-year-old.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the trauma surgeons did a calculation for me. He did a calculation for me based on textbooks they have in the ER at Shock Trauma Center in Baltimore. And if you're 70 and your blood pressure 60 and you've been a victim of a trauma, you have less than a 50% chance of survival.
Wow. And so he was very, very close to death.
Oh, within an inch and a split second.
Although America never knew that.
No, and they, you know, and they tried to, you know, the White House didn't want Reagan, you know, part of it is like the legend of Reagan that's created this day, right? Like cracking the jokes that he did, and I can explain that. And, you know, like he sees Nancy Reagan comes into the ER as he has this chest tube in his side, and he doesn't complain or cry or whine. He looks at him and says, honey, I forgot to duck. You know,
yeah.
Then he's getting wheeled into surgery.
Did Nancy know how close to death he was?
Oh, definitely. She definitely did. In fact, I spoke at the Reagan Library, early April, and she was there in the front row as I talked. And this is like the worst day of her life, by the way.
Yeah.
And it's intimidating. She's a larger than life presence. And I heard her. Jerry Parr was with me, the agent, and I heard her tell Jerry Parr, 30 years. This is 30 years later, Jerry. Thank you for giving me my life back. And so, you know, she knows. She knew. They all knew. And, you know, Reagan gets wheeled into surgery. And, no, there he is. He cracks his neck with the best line of the day. He gets up on an elbow before they anesthetize him. He says, I hope you're all Republicans. And he lies back down. They knock him out. And, you know, these lines get out to the public. Oh, he was, you know, he was shot. Clearly that's bad, but he was brave and heroic. And he cracked jokes. So how serious could it be? But they admired him because this is the day where I like to say that, you know, Reagan's approval rating just a few days before the shooting was the lowest of any president in U.S. history at that time in their first term.
Mm-hmm.
He's shot. His obviously sympathy factor helps. Approval rating goes up. But another dynamic occurred. Reagan had a very scripted presidency, okay? I mean, he wrote a lot, but, you know, he wanted the script that way. But you're not going to dispute he had a very scripted presidency.
Right.
And do you ever feel like you get to know someone when they're scripted? Do we ever really feel like we get to know the inner real person? I don't feel. I think it's hard to feel like you know the president or a politician ever, like on a real level.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on March 30th, 1981, at 2:27 p.m., this script got thrown out the window. There's no script anymore.
Yeah.
We got to see who he really was. Oh, my God. He really is kind of a brave, kind of cowboy-esque figure who laughed at death. And I mean, who does that? And that was like it's those things that really, I think, came through and helped him separate the person from the politics so that later, like, you wouldn't believe at these readings I go to and stuff or events. And Democrats, of course, come, you know, liberals, conservatives, people. It's not really a political book. And Democrats, you know, I really didn't like his policies, but I got to tell you, I liked him as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really helped him, and I think that was cemented on this day.
Well, tell us that little story you were going to tell us from your endnote.
Okay. Well, there are a couple. One, that famous line, I hope you're all Republicans.
Right.
Reagan had tested it 20 minutes earlier in the ER. Right? I mean, who does that? He's in the ER. He looks up at Jerry Parr, the agent, and says, I hope they're all Republicans. And nurse hears him say it, too. And Reagan, it fell flat because people are busy. Jerry Parr remembers looking down at him saying, Jerry Parr's going out of his mind, okay? And he didn't think it was that funny. And he's like, okay, boss, whatever, you know? But Reagan knew he wanted to deliver a good line. It's good for the public. It's who he is. It's his essence. So he put it in his back pocket. 20 minutes later, 15 minutes later, in the OR, the operating room, he delivers it again. And I was actually really surprised by that until I figured out his filmography. 53
right.
Movies. What were his two best films?
King's Row and the Newt Rockne story.
Yep, Newt Rockne, All-American.
Yeah.
And the two best scenes in those two best movies are hospital-like deathbed scenes.
That's right, yeah. Where's the rest of me?
Yes, he knew it. He had to do it, right? And so then, he loved the I just found that fascinating about him. He added a level of respect. It wasn't just spontaneous, you know. He plotted it in a way. And then I really came to like, you know, he loved this code name Rawhide. And like in 1983, he's cutting brush at the ranch. He's always cutting brush or whatever. He's digging around these trees.
At least when they were taking pictures, he was cutting brush.
Yes, he made sure there were a lot of pictures of that, right? And you know, Bob DeProspero, his lead agent at the time in 1983, looked down and said, "You know, Mr. President, there are a lot of rattlesnakes out here, and Bob DeProspero is not just protecting from assassins, but like he's plotting on that. We're on this ranch. We're not anywhere near medical facilities, and there are rattlesnakes everywhere. If he gets bitten by a rattlesnake, how in the world do I get him to the anti-venom?"
Right.
So he goes, because he just seen some. He goes, "Mr. President, I'd feel a lot better if you let someone else root around those trees, okay? Because there's some rattlesnakes around." Reagan gets up, looks at him, and says, "Well, Bob, I'm not a good Reagan impersonation, but I can't help it. Well, Bob, with a name like Rawhide, you can't be afraid." And so he loved that name, and, you know, it's things like that.
Well, there's so much in the book. It's really detailed and amazing, and the author is my guest, Del Quinton Wilbur, and the book is called Rawhide Down, The Near Assassination of Ronald Reagan. And I want to thank you so much for being here on the show. What are you going to do next? What's your follow-up?
I don't know. I'm just going to keep doing my job at the Washington Post and, you know, see what I can do. And, I'm hoping I can find another project where I get all these characters and everything and have those moments like, you know, there's a moment when I was reporting this book where I knew I really had a good book and I'm looking for another thing like that. And the moment came and when I tracked down Dr. David Adelberg, 31-year-old surgical intern on this day, and this is what I'm looking for in my next one. When you're building a scene like you are in the operating room, you have to interview 30 years later, you have to interview everybody to build that scene. And so I just called this guy up, Dr. David Adelberg. He was a 31-year-old surgical intern who helped on Reagan surgery, and I really wanted to get him. And I finally get him on the phone, and I find out what his job was. Well, as Ben Aaron, the main surgeon's hunting for this bullet in Reagan's chest, frantic that the bullet may slip into an artery and shoot into Reagan's brain, 31-year-old David Adelberg, just 31, a kid, nobody, reached his hand inside the president's chest, gently cupped his beating heart in his hand, and nudged aside. He held Reagan's beating heart in his hand, a 31-year-old kid, in this room surrounded by Secret Service agents armed to the teeth, ready to pounce at a moment's notice, or at least a dozen in this room. But there's this guy who that morning was going to wake up to do gallbladder surgery or something, holding Reagan's life in his hand. And that's what, in the next project, I'm hoping that, you know, whatever it is, that I get a moment like that. When I had that interview, it was probably halfway through my interviews, I went, "Oh my God, that is just the coolest thing. No one's ever talked to that guy before about that." That's what I'm looking for in the next one.
Well, Del Quinton Wilbur, you've got a lot of great stories to tell. When your book, Rawhide Down, The Near Assassination of Ronald Reagan, comes out in paperback, come and share some more with us.
I will.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on iTunes and Facebook. I want to thank my guest this week, Del Quinton Wilbur. His book is called Rawhide Down, The Near Assassination of Ronald Reagan. I also want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.